This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Todd Gabler showed up to testify 6 weeks after neck fusion surgery. You walked in with a cane. You had the big neck brace on. Told the judge that you even skipped your pain medication so your mind would be clear. We all saw that and we're like, bravo, this man is here with a mission and he has a purpose to be here. Joining the conversation to discuss all this, Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. And of course, our guest, Todd Gabler, is with us. Todd, just in your own words, obviously you made it happen to be there. As concise as you can be about it, why was it so important for you to be there that day and have your voice heard and have your findings be heard in front of that jury?
Well, you know, the spinal cord injury that I had was severe. It needed to be corrected. And for me to be able to walk and feel things in my hands and feet, the recovery from that surgery is 52 weeks, so a year.
Yeah.
And traveling in an airplane was excruciating.
Yeah.
But this is not the kind of case that I was willing to phone in or Zoom from. The seriousness of this case, the over 900 hours of investigation that I had in this case, I did not believe that that was appropriate for me to simply Zoom call it in. There, you know, we live in a world today that is this, what we're doing right now, right here.
Yeah.
But that is not appropriate for a trial. There are things that happen in real time inside that courtroom that I would not be able to respond to or understand. And so for some things, this type of interaction is appropriate. Mm-hmm. For a trial about where a life hangs in the balance, it's just not appropriate to appear telephonically.
Sure.
You know, Todd, nice to meet you. Great to be here with you. I was just listening in on the last segment, and your knowledge of human beings is really high level, profound. I mean, it's obvious you've been doing this for a very, very long time. You've been studying people a long time. You nailed the homicidal psychopath really, really well. I mean, and yeah, people shouldn't be afraid to say it. And clinicians want to weigh in, okay, homicidal with psychopathic observed traits, okay, for the clinicians out there. People like Corey Richards, and I know some psychopaths that actually clinically diagnosed that actually took the time to get diagnosed, their awareness of it, and so they do things in their life to mitigate those things, and so they have a self-awareness, which is very rare. And like you said, they are all around us, and not all of them manifest like Corey did. Who apparently does not have any level of self-awareness at all, but you have a high level. And since, where did you think that came from? You know, so at what point, what was that spark to become who you were, to actually do that deep dive, to become the person in the courtroom that they needed to actually bring this to closure?
Well, as to personality traits, I will confess that I am an empathetic personality. I very much am interested in how people feel, how they respond, what their motivations are. And I think this is exceptionally helpful in interviewing all people of all personality types. You need to acknowledge people, make sure that they feel understood so that they will open up to you and talk to you about things that are sometimes very painful. There's a lot of trauma in the job that I did. And in order to unlock memories about that trauma, you've got to empathize with people so that they trust you with that exceptionally traumatic memory. So that has been a practice in my interviewing techniques over the years. And I also have experience with narcissistic, certainly severe narcissism in my own personal life, You know, I slept next to a severe narcissist for many years and experienced the lying and the cheating and the stealing. And what it allows me to do is recognize those clues for what they are. And in particular, I think that the record reflects, I didn't know Eric Richens, yeah. But I think what I learned was that he was very much an empathetic personality. And this is the type of person that a Corey will prey upon.
Yes.
We all saw Josh Grossman on the stand. Empathetic personality? Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. And she preys upon that type of person.
Yeah, that's what they do.
We saw Greg Hall, her friend, talk at the sentencing. Greg Hall is the definition of an empathetic personality. And Corey preys upon that type of personality to get what she wants.
You spent a long time going through the devices, through Eric's devices and such, and obviously you never met him, but you almost kind of got to meet his ghost in a certain way, if you will. After spending all that time pouring through the messages, seeing the interactions between him and Corey, obviously he's an empathetic person, but what else did you learn about Eric? How was that relationship? Who was he in relation to her? How was he as a husband swimming in the same pool with that shark that is Corey Richens? How did he navigate those waters from what you saw?
Yeah, this is a difficult and complex question. And people often ask, why would Eric go back there? Why would he go back into this abusive relationship and not simply divorce her and take the kids? Well, first of all, a divorce involves custody, 50-50 arrangements. And so that's an easy answer.
Yep.
The more complicated answer is the complex nature of a narcissist, a psychopath. There's a lot of overlap there, and it's a very complicated thing to try and untangle. But the important note here is that there are, in the empathetic personality dynamic with a psychopath or a narcissist, you are constantly looking for the good. You're constantly looking for the savable, the salvageable. You're trying to ignore the narcissistic, all of those traits that we've talked about. You're trying to discount those, and you're trying to find the good in people. Mm-hmm. And I've said before in my own case, I've always been able to find humanity in even the most irredeemable of people. This case has tasked me a great deal to find empathy for Corey, but I do have some. Corey was a product of her environment.
Yeah.
A lot of the murder cases that I handle, not all of them are psychopaths, but I do find one common thread in all of the homicides that I have handled, and that is the primary maternal disruption. The disruption in your relationship with a maternal figure. It doesn't have to necessarily be your biological mom. Could be, a substitute mother. But if you do not have that influence early in your life, you are not imprinted with the value of human life, the value that human life has beyond you. And I've noticed that in every case, in one way or another, there is a maternal dysfunction, and there that in that maternal relationship there is a severe dysfunction. I don't have to opine on Corey's maternal dysfunction because you heard about it in the Orange Notebook that has evidence. In this case, the treatment of Corey and her siblings as objects to be to be handled like chattel, that is apparent and obvious. When you are dealing with a person who is addicted to gambling everything gets reduced to money. Everything gets reduced to the value it has for your next fix in the gambling hall. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that children are treated as objects, this is where she learns it. And she learns how to treat children as objects, and she goes on to treat her own children as objects, as pawns, to be bartered, to be traded, to be used as bargaining chips with the Richens family. And let me, you know, I want to talk for a second about this. This is important. This was a crime against children, what Corey did. There were multiple victims in this case. She exploited those children and their face and their images for her own ends. She published their picture in books, in a book. She manipulated these children as objects. She locked them in rooms. She manipulated them, their visitation with their paternal grandfather, only when she could get something in trade for time with her children. The fact that she cannot, that the court in this case could not enter an order to protect those children beyond the age of 18, something's got to be changed about that law.
Yeah.
These children are victims. To the extent that you have a YouTube channel or a documentary or a movie that puts these children's faces out on the internet, you are engaging in the same exploitation of these children. You are re-victimizing them. What you are doing is unconscionable.
Yeah.
If you have done this and you know who you are, you need to change that. You are manipulating children for your own exploitive ends, for your own profit. What you are doing is continuing the script of Corey Darden in exploiting her children. And I think my level of disgust for that is probably evident in my voice.
Yeah, she is no doubt a broken pile of genetic goo. Todd,
that's a very scientific term.
There's certain people that we talk about on the show that I can't class as human, so I got to come up with other words for them because she doesn't raise human beings. I mean, she's just a pile of goo. So, you know, we started talking about Eric and the beautiful human being he was and the dad he was. Did you see any kind of lever of manipulation that was her go-to with him, do you think? Because you really dove deep on that pile of goo. What do you think? I know the children were a pile. I mean, not a pile. The children she was using as influence and control in her own life. I mean, she was using everything around her. But was there a go-to that she was constantly going back to that Eric fell victim to? And I only ask for that question too for other people listening, you know, hey, be wary of this if it happens in your life.
Yeah, the thing that really sticks out for me on that score is just the sort of the emotional distance. I think that you saw Eric very involved, hyper involved, I would suggest. He's coaching all of the teams. He's got these kids all the time. He's very involved in all of that. I think Corey sees that she wants to have a career in real estate. And so that becomes a substitute for the lack of a completeness that she thinks she's going to get from being married and having children. Remember, these are Corey's words. Corey says that she thought that having children and being married would bring her all the happiness she needed, but it wasn't enough. And so she goes and gets this career, and she thinks that the accumulation of wealth and status and privilege, she thinks that's going to bring her happiness, but it doesn't. It's an insatiable, unquenchable desire that is part of the psychopathic personality. It's just straight down the middle. It's not even tangential.
I know. It's the total lack of ability. that she never felt joy. I mean, did you ever see or experience anyone on that psychopathic scale that actually could actually have joy, that is actually genuine joy, even in her own children?
The level of psychopathy here is profound.
Yeah.
There is, I think that there is imitation of joy. I think that there is signatures of joy. That's the, you know, the vacation condo, the vacation trip to Greece, the vacation trip here, the glamour of it all, the all of the, you know, the makeup and the tummy tucks and the, you know, the day-long spa treatments. Those are all supposed to bring her joy, but none of them do.
Chasing, always chasing.
As she sits in her cell right now, do you think she believes that she's innocent in this?
It's hard to get into that mind.
Yeah.
Now that we all know what I have known for many years, and you, the public, have just become aware of, Corey never left that bedroom that night.
Yeah.
Her children were frantically trying to get in. Think about that for a minute.
Yeah. The horror. Yeah.
It's a tough thing even for me now to think about. This is a horrible, horrible thing. So does she think about this in herself? She is the only one who was inside that bedroom for the better part of 8 hours before 911 is called. Does she have memories from that? I'm quite certain that she does.
Yeah.
I don't believe she has the capacity to wipe that from her mind.
Yeah.
It is not the way the human brain works. You can dress it up. You can put lipstick on it, but it is still what it is. And I've got to think that those memories she is trying mightily, those images, those memories, those sensations, I would think she is trying mightily to eliminate those from her mind.
Yeah, and, finding a way to frame it that's palatable for her to continue existing is what she's probably trying to do there.
Well, she's definitely great at constructs, right?
She is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
She wrecks these all over the place. It's about her success in business and about all of these other things that she's just lying about.
I'd imagine she might have said something to herself of, well, it was going to happen eventually anyway. I just hurried it along. Yeah. That's a rationalization of a psychopath.
I think there are all kinds of excuses. Yeah. And then when you heard this feeble defense that Eric was having an affair, maybe there was a homosexual affair. That's a false equivalence. Number one, it's a false equivalence. Number two, it's deflection. It is, he did it too, so I'm okay to do it. And it's perfect narcissism. It's part of psychopathology. It's, again, right down the middle.
Yep.
And it also happens to be false. I investigated whether or not Eric was having an affair of any kind with a woman who he encountered in his workplace. That is false. There was no emotional affair. There was no physical affair, period.
Thanks for making that distinction, too, of not even an emotional affair. Thank you. Good. Keep going.
Yeah, nothing's there, yeah.
There is zero evidence of that. I spoke with this woman who Corey alleged to be having an affair with her husband. Her allegations are false. The idea that Bryce and Eric were engaged in a sexual relationship is laughable. It is despicable. It does damage to Eric's memory. It does damage to Bryce's reputation. It is false. And it is inconsequential to whether or not she killed her husband. They raise this at a trial where the question is, did you kill your husband? The idea that him having an affair of any kind has bearing on that has only a negative outcome on her motivations. The only way that an affair of Eric's could have any effect is to provide her additional motive to murder him.
Right.
I don't understand why the defense thinks this is a good idea. It is false. It is damaging. And it provides another motive for Corey to murder her husband. This idea that she can excuse her own deplorable behavior by accusing someone else of it is a well-known phenomenon, established first on elementary school playgrounds all over the world. You know, I didn't hit him. It was her. And this sort of juvenile displacement is, as an adult, is immature, despicable. It lacks any seriousness with respect to the professional responsibility that should be attendant to lawyers in a courtroom. I think that it is, in the end, it shows again the true nature of Corey, and it shows the desperation that must have been present in this defense to raise it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think you could really go any other way as to why they went down some of those roads. Todd Gabler, private investigator, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your experiences. You know, I know we were just touching, you know, the surface of the depths to which you went down in this this road, but I think you certainly served Eric well, and you served those kids well. Thank you for what you did for that family and that trial, and thank you for sharing your experiences with us today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Todd. Amazing.
I was grateful to be of service, and I was grateful to be here with you today. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love to hear from you. Links are in the description. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now, and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.